If you enjoy The Spectator's podcast, why not subscribe to the magazine as well? You can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. This is a podcast-only deal, and we hope you take us up on it.
Hello and welcome to The Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator. My guest this week is a scholar, Selina Wisnom, whose new book is The Library of Ancient Wisdom, Mesopotamia and the Making of History. And this is a book that tells us all about something that most of us will know very little about indeed, which is to say cuneiform culture. And cuneiform is the world's first writing system. But Selina, can you kind of explain a bit what the territory we're looking at is? Because here's something that, you know, a system that covers thousands of years and multiple languages and multiple civilizations under one kind of wedge-shaped umbrella.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling in its extent, really. I mean, Mesopotamia is an ancient name for what is now modern-day Iraq. It's Greek for between the rivers, and those rivers are the Tigris and Euphrates, which run through the Fertile Crescent in the Near East, which is where agriculture took off, where we have the world's first megacities, where writing is invented, and all of that starts. So writing is invented about 3100 BC, and cuneiform continues to be used right up until the first century AD. So it is more than 3000 years time span that it was used. And in that time, lots of different people are using it. So the Sumerians invent writing originally in the turn of the 4th millennium BC, but then the writing system is adapted. So when the Akkadian speakers come along, it's used to write their language. The Babylonians use it, the Assyrians use it, and it's adapted even further afield. So we even get Old Persian adapted to be written in a type of cuneiform.
And in, as you say, when we were trying to figure out how to decode it, the fact that it was used for multiple languages caused no end of trouble, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it was a great help in some ways because we had trilingual inscriptions in three different languages, but which is a bit like the Rosetta Stone. Unlike the Rosetta Stone, though, we didn't know how to read any of those three languages, so there was no head start to help out. So Old Persian was decoded first, because that's related to modern Persian, so there was some link there. But when it came to deciphering Akkadian, Akkadian is a script that also retains some Sumerian words within it. So it's a little bit like Japanese, actually. In Japanese, they will spell out syllables of words, but they will also sometimes use Chinese characters. And that's exactly what was happening with Akkadian. So every now and again, you'd get a Sumerian word thrown into the middle of the sentence, but written in the same script. So it would be a little bit like coming across the word pain in an English text and suddenly realizing you were meant to be reading it as French for bread.
Extraordinary. And about when was it that we started to be able to decode this? Was it about the same time as Rosetta Stone, or a bit later?
A little bit later. So it was mid-19th century that happened. And it was a decipherment effort that took about 50 years, actually. It was a long, prolonged effort of numerous scholars.
And we've obviously, I mean, judging by the extraordinary quotation, we'll get onto the place you're quoting from most extensively. But, you know, we seem to have decoded it extraordinarily well. I mean, it's so rich and polysemous, as you describe it.
Yeah, it's amazing how much we can read in this language, or these languages, actually. We have probably about 500,000 sources written in cuneiform from this 3,000-year time span. And there's so many of them that are still waiting to be read, and new sources are turning up all the time. So it's one of the most exciting things about working in this field is that new texts are constantly appearing. We're getting new bits of text constantly appearing. You know, a tablet can break. These are written on clay tablets, which is an amazing material because they don't decay in the ground. If you burn down a library full of clay tablets, well, actually bakes the clay and preserves it forever. So they're very durable in some ways, but in other ways they are fragile. You know, if it falls off a shelf, it might shatter. And then those pieces need to be put back together. And that's something that's still an ongoing effort as well. And it's very exciting when you suddenly find a missing bit of a tablet and new lines appear in a text you already think you know well.
Well, do we have a sense of how this first writing form emerged? How was writing invented? I mean, I know, as you say, the Sumerians or Babylonians had their own myths about it. But do we have a sense of what happened?
Yes, and that's one of the extraordinary things about it, is that we can track the stages of the evolution of the development of writing in great detail, because we have them all. We have clay tablets from different stages of this process. So we can see how very early on they are drawing pictures to represent the words that they want to write down. Later on, they then use those pictures to represent the sounds. So, for instance, if you want to write a person or for a ration, you'd write a head. That's pronounced sang in Sumerian. But later on, if you want to write a different word that has that same syllable in it, like orasang, which means hero, you're going to write the picture of the head to represent that same syllable. And that's what makes the script really take off, and it's how it can be adapted for so many different languages.
Now, this library that is the centre of your book, and it zeroes in, to some extent, a present day in the vast kind of area that you're covering by implication. Tell us about that. It precedes, doesn't it, its more famous cousin in Alexandria?
Yes, that's right. It was assembled in the 7th century BC by an Assyrian king called Ashurbanipal, somebody that most people have never heard of, but his achievements are extremely helpful for us now. He was a military man who was also interested in writing and scholarship. And he was probably never intended to be king. He boasts in his own inscriptions about how he's trained as a scholar, for instance, and how he can debate with his scholars and play them at their own game. He can understand the advice that's being given to him. And it's probably for this reason that he takes such an interest in amassing all the knowledge that he can find in his empire. So the library is a reflection of his personal interests, and it's also a collection of all the traditional wisdom of Mesopotamia. So he sends people out to all the major cities in his empire, asking them to send copies of obscure texts so that he can have everything back in his library. And then his scholars will copy it into their own very beautiful, neat Assyrian handwriting, which is so lovely. We sometimes call it typewriter cuneiform, and inscribe it with a label at the end saying that this is his property in his palace. And some of those labels even say, you know, that I deposited it in my palace for my royal viewing and reading out.
And this library comes down to us because, well, I mean, you know, we always say the great tragedy was the burning of the Great Library of Alexandria. The great boon to us was the burning of the Great Library of Nineveh, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly. That's the most wonderful irony of it, that destroying the library actually preserved it. So in 612 BC, when the Babylonians sacked Nineveh, they burned down the palace. They probably also rifled through the collection and took away things that were useful to them, things that were interesting to them, which is why we don't actually have the library as one physical place. The tablets were found scattered all over the palace, all over the hill, actually. Yeah, the fact that they've left so much for us is really extraordinary.
And the period that Ashurbanipal was in charge, I mean, this is a kind of the Akkadian period you're talking about, that's a height. And as you describe it, there's a kind of political wrestle that goes on for many centuries between Assyria in the north and Babylon in the south.
Yes. So Babylon had been the cultural centre of the Near East for a very long time. I mean, since the early 2nd millennium BC is when Babylon first rises to prominence, when it becomes a political giant, and when many of these texts that are in the library were first written. And in fact, the library does contain texts directly dating from that time. There's even a letter from a scholar saying to Ashurbanipal, I will fetch a tablet from the time of King Hammurabi. So they also have a sense themselves of this incredibly rich history and the long time span of their own culture. But yeah, the Assyrians are in the north, the Babylonians are in the south. Their fortunes sort of rise and fall alternately over the centuries. And at this point, Assyria has a control over Babylon, but it's a very uneasy relationship. Ashurbanipal's father, he split the empire on his death and made Ashurbanipal's brother king of Babylon and Ashurbanipal king of Assyria. But Ashurbanipal behaves as if he's king of Babylon himself, actually. So much so that it's hard for us to tell how much Babylon was ever even supposed to be independent. Was it supposed to be an independent state, or was it just supposed to be a sort of smaller province of Assyria? But Ashurbanipal's brother gets fed up of this. He rebels, he invades Assyria, and this launches a very bitter four-year conflict, which does, in fact, end with Ashurbanipal winning. But at what cost? I think it's a terrible thing for Assyria to have destroyed Babylon, and that's something that really hangs over the Assyrians. But it also has consequences for the library, because after the sack of Babylon, Ashurbanipal confiscates tablets belonging to scholars in that city. And he even brings some of them back to Assyria and forces them to work on the library. We've even got letters saying that, you know, so-and-so is copying this text and he'll be put back in chains between jobs.
Another consequence, another thing that comes out of Assyria invading Babylon is they pinch their god. And the setup with the way they worship their gods is kind of fascinating and very, very sort of different to how we'd understand it, isn't it? I mean, how did their pantheon and their obeisance to their pantheons look?
Each city has got their own patron god, who they worship above all. So Assyria is a special case because the name Assyria really means land of the god Ashur. So Ashur is the patron deity of the main capital of Assyria, Ashur, before Nineveh. It moves around quite a bit, but Ashur is definitely the religious centre of the empire. And in Babylon, the main patron god is Marduk. So yes, when cities conquer each other, they do make off with statues of the god of that city. And that was thought to mean that the god himself was abandoning the city. It was a way of explaining why terrible things happened. It was a way of explaining why people were suffering. The god had left, so of course they were on their own.
So these statues, I mean, obviously we're primed, aren't we, by the Christian prohibition on worshipping graven images, but they were very much worshipped, weren't they? I mean, they were like, the statue was the personification of the god. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing that you're like feeding them three meals a day or four meals a day.
Yes, exactly. These statues were treated as if the god really did inhabit them. There were also many of them, though that's the other thing. There wasn't just one statue of Marduk, there would have been several, which is another interesting reflection of that the god could be in several places at once. But they have these special rituals to bring the statue to life, because it's a great paradox as well, of course. I mean, how can a statue, which they very obviously know has been made by human hands, be divine? And we have the texts that describe this process, which I think is amazing because it's one of the greatest mysteries of Babylonian religion, how this happens. And we have the texts that spell out exactly how they did it. And they describe this process as, well, the statues being born in heaven but made on earth.
And how do they, as it were, repristinate them once human craftsmen have made them?
Well, there's a long series of rituals they go through. They take them out of the workshop, they take them down to the riverbank, they make offerings to them, and lots of incantations. So they're saying lots of magical spells over them to transform it into a god. And they perform this ritual called mouth washing and mouth opening, which they also have in Egypt, actually. But this is the one thing the texts don't tell us how to do. They just say, you perform mouth washing, and then we don't know what that is, but everything else we've got. And one of my favourite things about this ritual is how the craftsmen are summoned to the riverbank, and then they are told to deny any connection they have with making the statue. So they bind their hands with some kind of scarf. They take a wooden knife, and they symbolically cut off the hands of the craftsmen, and each of them say, I did not make you. Ea of the goldsmith made you. I did not make you. The god of the craftsmen made you. And each one of them will say that, you know, regardless of what their profession is, so that each of them are saying, no, I was acting on behalf of the gods. And then what they do is they take the tools that were used to make the statue, they open up a sheep, put the tools inside the sheep, sew it up and chuck it in the river and send it and send the tools back to the domain of the god of craftsmanship, wisdom and magic, who they are symbolically borrowing them from.
What was the understanding that they had about the way the gods behaved? Because, I mean, one thinks of the kind of Greco-Roman pantheon as being kind of weirdly capricious, and that seems to come in some sense from here, doesn't it?
They're very similar in that sense, yeah. The gods have all sorts of recognisable human emotions. They behave, well, we would say quite pettily in some ways. One of my favourite examples of this is the reason that's given for the universal flood. So the Babylonians have a story very similar to that in the Bible of a great deluge sweeping over the earth, somebody being told to build a boat to take all examples of life inside so that humanity can survive and start again. But there's a huge disagreement among the gods about all of this in the first place. And the reason why the flood was sent is because the chief god Enlil just can't sleep. Human beings are making too much noise. It's really annoying him. And so in a fit of sleep-deprived rage, he just says, oh, let's kill them all, essentially. So that's one of the great moments of character, I think, when they're showing that they have human-like personalities.
It's this lovely bit where you say that they kind of afterwards, I think it's another god, says, look, don't do that because we'll all be cooked if we haven't got anyone to make us offerings.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in this poem, human beings are created so that they can farm the land and that they can make offerings to the gods. And the gods need that. So exactly, it's an example of how he was acting very thoughtlessly and not really thinking this through, that this would backfire hugely.
And I mean, as well as understanding what the gods are up to, it seems to be, as you describe it, because a lot of your book describes all the different sort of the tablets of magic and of divination and of understanding the signs of the skies. I mean, they lived in a kind of world of perpetual signs and wonders, didn't they? I mean, everything was up for interpretation.
Absolutely. They believed that the gods were constantly in communication with them, and the gods would send signs through the natural world to show their approval, their disapproval, to give clues about what was going to happen next. So astrology is a quintessential Babylonian science. It's something that they spent hundreds of years developing. They would watch the skies, keep track of the movements of the planets, the stars, anything unusual happening, but also things that they could predict would also count as omens. And on Earth as well, anything unusual happening, if a lizard falls on your shoulder, it would mean something. And what it would mean would depend exactly where it fell. Was it your left shoulder? Was it your right shoulder? Did it fall in front of you? Did it fall behind you? Were you sitting down having dinner as it fell or not? Has a white cat crossed your path when you're out in the street? Did a dog enter your home accidentally? And all of these things could have meaning and could be looked up in this omen series.
On the face of it, it makes someone like me think these people had a worldview that was completely alien to us. But one of the arguments of your book that I found most compelling is that actually they are more recognisable than that might make them sound. How do you frame that?
Yeah, very much so. I think it's quite hard for us to get into that mindset where you're living in a world that where magic is real and all of these signs and wonders are all around you, as you say. But I think when we think about the thinking behind it, it emerges to be a lot more rational than we think. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to explain why the world is the way it is. And they just start from different premises than we do. So if you believe that there are these all-powerful gods who intervene in human life in this way, it makes sense you'd think that they'd want to communicate with us. It makes sense that you would want to look out for the strange things happening in the world around you, things out of the ordinary. And then they turn it into a system. They are trying to organize these omens, these strange happenings. They're trying to make sense of them. And it's their way of trying to be logical about it, actually. Now, of course, we start from completely different ideas of what is logical and why things could be the way they are. But if we put ourselves in that mindset, it's not so strange, actually. And it's the way that many other cultures still think around the world today.
Also, there's a sort of scientific science comes out of this, doesn't it? Because, for example, the Babylonians invent mathematical astronomy, which
yes.
is, you know, something that's still handy.
Yeah, they have been keeping watch over the sky for more than 600 years. They have 600 years worth of observational data, and that is what allows them to spot patterns in the movements of the planets. And they have so much data that by the end, they don't need to keep watch anymore because they can extrapolate algorithms and calculations from all of this data. And they are the first people we know of to do that, actually. The very idea that you can extrapolate these trends from data is their idea. And the Greeks pick up their data, the Greeks pick up some of these ideas, and that informs Greek astronomy, and that's how it's come down to us.
In terms of the way they understood the signs of portents, I mean, you say there's like, you know, there's a full-time exorcist
yeah.
who is extremely busy.
Many
you
of
describe
them.
It. Yeah, many full-time exorcists who are run off their feet doing exorcism. But was there a sort of hierarchy of different levels of magical thinking? Because as you describe it, the business of expixtacy, of looking at the entrails of sacrificed animals, was like that was the kind of gold standard for prediction.
Mm.
And other things were a bit more, not sure about that.
Well, they're all important for different reasons, I think. So At the time of the library in the 7th century BC, we haven't quite gotten to mathematical astronomy yet. They've got a lot of data behind them. They can make pretty confident guesses about things like when eclipses will happen, but they don't always know for sure. And there's also the fact that sometimes the sky is cloudy and you can't actually see what's happened. I mean, the astronomical diaries of Babylon, where they are keeping these records, are full of entries that just say it was overcast. You know, we couldn't see anything. So that's why you need an alternative method. And this ixdispasy, which is a divination from sheep entrails, one of the strangest things from our modern perspective that they do, is used as a check on that. So if they're not sure about anything, you can go and ask the entrails. You can go and sacrifice a sheep, open it up. At the moment that you ask the question, they believe that the gods have written the answer on the entrails, and that's the way that they can confirm or deny anything that they want to know.
And, I mean, how have the gods written on the entrails of the sheep? Because, as you described, it's a very, very precise manual for what everything means, isn't there?
Yes, there are 10,000 different omens explaining how to interpret different marks on the entrails. We've got maybe about a third to half of them that have survived for us. It's different creases appearing. So this is something that I do in my academic work. I reconstruct this process, and I've done sort of election forecasting for fun and research purposes, just to see how it works. You know, I predicted Donald Trump's election in 2016, for instance, and have done others since that. So this has given me a kind of hands-on experience to understand what they're looking at. And livers, I mean, animals like human beings have very individual creatures, right? So there are main parts of the anatomy that, okay, like most sheep will have, but they will look different in each one. And so what you're looking at is the shapes of the creases in different parts of the liver. They've split it up into 12 different zones, and you inspect those zones very systematically. You go through them one by one, and you're looking for, you know, does the crease point that way or that way? How many of them are there? Is it long? Is it short? Is there any parasite damage in the liver? Those sorts of things. And then there's a system to explain what it means. And the omens are couched in this sort of beautifully mysterious to us language. They say things like, if a design is drawn between the palace gate and the presence, it means the gods have heard the wailing of the land. And I read these and I think, wow, but these are all technical terms. They each have a very precise meaning.
So palace gate is one bit of the liver.
Yes, exactly. A design is probably the scars left by parasites moving around. The presence is a crease in the left lobe that signifies that the gods are there in the sacrifice, things like that. But actually, in the end, all they're looking for is a yes or no answer. So the gods have heard the wailing of the land. That's probably a good thing. You want the gods to listen to your prayers. So you chalk that up as a yes. And at the end, you count up, do you have more negative signs or more positive signs? And whichever one it is will give you the answer to your question, yes or no.
Extraordinary. And another kind of way in which I think you say, like, these guys, you know, are not as alien, if you think rightly into the mindset. So that medically speaking, because a lot of medical documents in this survive from this library.
Yeah.
You've got a sort of twin track that the exorcist and the doctor will both be working on disease at the same time.
Yes, exactly. It's quite holistic in this way, actually. So you've got physicians who deal mostly with the physical treatments. They deal with lists of plants, medical drugs, and so on. And then the exorcist deals with the spiritual reasons. You know, why has the disease afflicted this person? Usually because the gods are angry in some way, and it's the exorcist's job to put that right, to reconcile the patient with the gods. Or it could be witchcraft. There's also a story in the book about the Queen Mother being afflicted by witchcraft or a curse, and it's the exorcist's job to deal with that. But witchcraft is actually a very diagnosable affliction. So they're physical symptoms that will suggest that you've been cursed. But they each also use a little bit of each other's knowledge. So it's not quite so divided up as we might think. And they work together, ultimately. And that's, we've got letters from both the king's physician and the king's exorcist writing about similar problems. Then we can really see that.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the Queen Mother, who at that point is quite a powerful figure. I mean, you know, it's a patriarchal society. But as you describe it, actually, there were more roles for women at various points in this than maybe we might think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Queen Mother was hugely powerful. Assyrian queens had their own armies. She was involved in military strategy. We've got letters written from the advisors directly to her, as well as to the king. And she was somebody that the king really thought he could trust, which is not a surprise given the political circumstances that he was surrounded by. I mean, this particular king is Esarhaddon, so that's Ashurbanipal's father. He faced down at least three different conspiracies to oust him from the throne. So, you know, of course, his mother is going to be somebody that he can trust. He's not going to be caught up in all of this.
And it became sort of more patriarchal, if I'm getting this right, that the Sumerian pantheon, for instance, was more, as it were, female, and that they got sort of, as we moved into Akkadian culture, there was a reorganization of society and a reorganization of the places of the female gods, with maybe the exception of Ishtar. Is that right?
Yes, there does seem to be some of that. So the goddess of scribes in Sumerian culture is Nisaba, but by the time we get to the first millennium, it's Nabu, who is Marduk's son, who is now the patron god of scribes. So there are examples like that. And Ishtar seems to take over. You know, she's a goddess of sexuality and war, but she's definitely the most revered goddess. She becomes one of the key goddesses of the Assyrian state as well. She's there on the battlefield with Ashurbanipal, telling Ashurbanipal to stay at home and have fun eating and drinking while she goes on the battlefield for him, in fact.
Yes, that's right. That's Ashurbanipal, obviously, he was, you know, he's kind of bookish, nerdy type. Was he a bit less of a tough guy than he liked to make out, do you think?
I suspect so, yeah. I mean, this incident with Ishtar telling him to stay at home is highly suspicious in many ways, I think. He does say in his autobiography that, you know, he was trained to shoot a bow and ride a horse and everything. But Assyrian kings were not usually on the battlefields themselves. That does make sense, really, because you don't want your commander to be killed. And in fact, his grandfather, great-grandfather, Sargon, met a terrible end for this reason. So Sargon was killed in battle and the enemy carried off his body, and that meant that they couldn't bury him. And that is an absolute disaster in Assyrian culture, because if you can't bury your dead, you can't make offerings to their ghosts in the netherworld. And they used to do this in a really literal way. I mean, they would actually put tubes into the ground and pour beer down the tube so that the ghost could drink. And there is a part of the Epic of Gilgamesh that describes the fate of people who can't receive offerings in this way. And they go mad, really. They go mad with thirst and they come back to haunt people. And it's even been proposed that this might be the reason that they abandoned the capital city that Sargon had only just finished building after his death, as a way to try and get away from all of this. So nerdy as he might be, he did also have good reasons to stay away from the battlefield.
Yes, indeed. Now, the business of battle, obviously this was hugely kind of important for Assyrian kings. They were expected to be fighting all the time. And I mean, I know Tom Holland talking about the, you know, arrival of Christianity or the New Testament Christianity said, you know, the great divide between the modern and the ancient world is the one in which the ancients were much, much, much crueler. The idea that being meek or being a victim could be anything other than denigrating is the great pivot point of history. I don't know whether you'd agree with that, but there's certainly a lot of cruelty available in your descriptions of Ashurbanipal. I mean, he's constantly chopping people's heads off and dangling them from trees and cutting off their lips and so forth, isn't there?
Yeah, that's true. It is definitely part of how he wants to be portrayed, because these are also reliefs that were displayed on his palace. So, for instance, you know, the head of the enemy king, Toman, dangling from that tree while he's having a banquet. That's on his palace walls for everyone to see. He does decorate his palace walls with depictions of his battles. And that's something that is quite shocking to a modern audience to see that. But I think it's just a different way of owning up to the violence that goes on. I think modern states engage in equally brutal practices, actually, but we don't celebrate them in the same way. We prefer to keep it all behind closed doors. I mean, you know, imagine if the US Capitol was decorated with images of Hiroshima, or the UK Houses of Parliament with scenes from the Opium Wars. It would be like that. So in a way, maybe the Assyrians are just more honest about what they're doing.
And a sort of corollary of that, which is a really, it seemed to me, a very interesting subtle point you make, is that in lots of these reliefs that survive, come down to us, the scenes of battle, the as it were, goodies the Assyrians are all very uniformly depicted, you know, they're as one. And you get really poignant images of whether it's lions they're hunting or Elamites they're putting to the sword, looking very individual and very agonised and frightened and upset. And we will tend to sympathise with the latter. Why is it that they're so uniform and that the, you know, anguish of their enemies is so individualised?
Oh, I suppose because to be imperfect is to be weak. They're depicting ideal types, right? I mean, all the Assyrian kings look the same as well. It's quite hard to tell apart Ashurbanipal from, you know, his father Esarhaddon or from his grandfather Sennacherib from the reliefs alone, unless you read the captions, because they are just conforming to the ideal type of power and strength. And that's the same for the Assyrian soldiers as well. As you say, they are acting as one. So the individuality is a way to, well, it's a way to humanize them, I suppose, which is something that we like and we admire and we sympathize with, but it's that very same humanity that means they can be destroyed.
So we're sort of reading it through a totally different prism.
Yeah.
And what was his relationship with the other kind? I mean, you've said there was a sort of fight with his brother over Babylon, but with the other territories of his empire. I mean, I was kind of struck by you describing how when he took somewhere over, he would sort of disperse the population, slightly like the Russians sending Ukrainian children off into the Russian thing. There was a lot of relocation, or what we might now call ethnic cleansing, wasn't there?
Yes. So he sends people wherever they are useful. And there's two reasons for that. I mean, first of all, it makes sense as a strategy, because if you break up people, they can't rise up against you in quite the same way. And also the manpower is needed to carry out infrastructure projects throughout the empire. You know, he might send them to places he would need to develop, to build roads, to develop agriculture, and so on. And so this has a really profound impact on the ethnic makeup of the Near East, really. The Assyrians have been doing this for generations. The Babylonians continue doing it, sending people around wherever they're needed. This is ultimately how the Judeans end up in Babylon after Nebuchadnezzar, who's a little bit after Ashurbanipal. He destroys Jerusalem and moves the Judeans into Babylon. And this is where they encounter the great myths of Babylonian culture, you know, like the flood story.
And do you subscribe to the notion, which I think, you know, various scholars have put forward, that essentially the Old Testament, kind of they were copying the Babylonians' homework in some of it?
Well, I think there's different ways of viewing that. Some people also think that some of these stories might be floating around in the same area for a long time and they have different takes on it. But what I do find really interesting is the differences between them. It's really telling. I think there are instances where you can see that the stories are very similar, but the different choices that are made reveal so much about what each culture values. So, for instance, the flood story, the fact that the Babylonian gods are doing it just because they're sleep deprived, this tells us that for the Babylonians, they think that, well, the gods are just kind of making things up as they go along. That's very different from the way the Hebrew Bible has got some kind of higher moral authority and saying, oh, it's because people are sinful. So each one reveals something very different. I think the Tower of Babel story in Genesis is a direct reaction to Babylonian culture. The Tower of Babel story is where on the plain of Shinar, which is what they call Sumer in the Bible, the people decide to build a tower that will reach the heavens. And this is seen as a terribly arrogant thing to do. And God strikes them down for doing it and makes them all speak different languages so they can't communicate anymore. And they all go off in different directions. Now, these towers were really built in Mesopotamia. So Babylonian temples called ziggurats, they do look like towers that reach the heavens. The temple of Marduk in Babylon is actually called Bond of Heaven and Earth. And the temple precinct itself is called, you know, the house that raises its head to the heavens. So that really is coming from somewhere and is a direct reaction against it and is saying that, well, they really don't approve.
Obviously, yeah, there's a lot of sacking of cities and, you know, relocation of people. It's extraordinary to me that being a lamentation priest is like a full-time job.
Yeah, it's
in Babylon. That lamentation is like a major activity. Can you explain that? I mean, it makes me think forward immediately to kind of Anglo-Saxons and biblical Book of Lamentation. And it obviously goes forward in more ways than are immediately obvious. But why was lamentation so important?
Well, lamentation is a particularly Babylonian practice, which the Assyrians pick up much later in their history. They import lamentation priests into Assyria, where the idea is if you lament to the gods about something that hasn't happened yet, the gods will no longer feel the need to do it. So you have these lamenters, you know, three or four times a day in the temple singing about how our city has been totally ruined. All of the walls of this temple have fallen down. There are only doves and mice living here now. When, of course, the temple is still standing all around them, everyone is perfectly happy. There's no war, nothing of the sort is happening. So this is deeply strange to us. Like, why on earth would they do that? But the idea is that it placates the gods in advance. So the gods are hearing this and they're thinking, okay, we see that you see that we could do this to you at any time. So therefore, there's no need for us to do it. It's a kind of insurance policy, I suppose, against divine anger.
And a detail which maybe is sort of semi-related, you said there's no Babylonian word for sorry.
No, there isn't. The way that they get around it is they have to describe how they feel about what they've done. You know, so they'll be like, oh, you know, I regret that this happened, which I think is actually a really important part of the reconciliation process. You know, it's much harder to say sorry and not mean it if you don't go through that. But for them, there's no shortcutting it. They have to say what they've done to make the other person unhappy. And I think that's quite profound.
Yeah. I mean, human agency, you know, one thinks of, in a kind of cursory way, you think about, well, people who believed in gods and miracles and the stars would be essentially kind of deterministic, fatalistic culture, but it seems the opposite is the case with the Assyrians.
Absolutely, because the way that they think of all of these omens and signs that are sent by the gods is that they are messages. So they don't think that if an eclipse happens, the eclipse will cause the king to die. It's just a message that if things carry on the way they are, then probably the king is going to die. And that gives them a chance to step in and intervene. So that's when you get all the exorcists out, where they start making their offerings to the gods, their prayers, their rituals, their incantations, and they are begging the gods to change their minds, saying, you know, we're sorry, please do things differently. And then the gods might listen, and the gods might, they might change the verdict. And the whole thing is set up like a law court, in fact. I think exorcists are, it's a bit like hiring a lawyer, hiring an exorcist, really. You're hiring somebody to plead on your behalf.
So you're negotiating.
Yeah, you're negotiating with the gods. And sometimes the gods will listen and they might change their minds, or they might not. You know, they don't have to.
And how much, as you see it, you know, what parts of this extraordinary culture can we see and can we trace in subsequent civilizations, and what parts have been sort of, as it were, junked and remain alien to us?
Well, in the realm of astronomy, there's a lot that's survived. So, for instance, the zodiac constellations that we use, they are all from Mesopotamia. Some of the names are even exactly the same. The fact that we measure time in base 60, you know, if we look at a clock and we're measuring 60 minutes in an hour, that comes from the Babylonian mathematical system where they divided everything by 60, not by 10. So, I mean, there are things like that which have come to us in a very immediate way, and lots of other things that dispersed in a more indirect way, I suppose. So one of the things that first got me into this subject were the connections with Greek and Roman culture. There's a whole world even before Homer, for instance, that's informing that. The great poet Hesiod as well was incredibly influenced by the myths of the ancient Near East. So there's a lot of influence there.
You talk about the Epic of Gilgamesh in here. Where, does that filter into sort of subsequent sort of Bronze Age texts?
Yeah, it's highly controversial exactly how. You know, people will argue about the details of it. But it's clear that these stories are circulating in the Near East in general. And it's clear that Greece is not an isolated part of the ancient world. It's interacting with the Near East. They're trading with the Near East. They're meeting these people. They have the material culture from the Near East is there. So they are coming into contact with all these things. So, for instance, the Gorgon, who Perseus fights, you know, with a snake-like hair whose gaze will turn anyone who looks at her to stone. I mean, that is probably actually a version of the monster Humbaba from the Epic of Gilgamesh. The monster that Gilgamesh kills in the Cedar Forest, and he takes his head back as a kind of magical amulet, I suppose, to ward off evil. And the Greeks were doing the same things and they transformed it into their own version of the myth.
I should say, you've got a lovely detail, speaking of magical amulets, that The Exorcist gets it completely wrong.
What do you mean?
That the Exorcist, the film The Exorcist.
Yes,
you say that
yes.
Scary demon that's supposed to be the monster. He's a benign figure in Babylonian culture, is that right?
Yes, exactly. So this demon is called Pazuzu. They have a very faithful reproduction of a statue of Pazuzu, I must say, at the beginning of the film. He's a terrifying figure with wings baring his teeth, which we know from Mesopotamian amulets, Mesopotamian statues. But this is actually a demon who was on the exorcist's side. So he was employed to drive away the other demons. He's king of all of the wind demons. People would have had little versions of his head on beads that they would thread around their necks to keep evil spirits away, which is another very surprising thing about Mesopotamia as well, that demons are not necessarily all evil.
And can you give me a sense of, you talk very eloquently about how moving some of those lists of lamentations can be in poetry and how the Epic of Gilgamesh can speak to us. Do you get a sense of real people's personalities coming through in this library?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. We have letters between the king and his advisors, which can be incredibly personal in tone. So, well, we mentioned the exorcist who is incredibly busy and rushed off his feet. This is one of my favourites because he's just so harassed. The king is complaining, you know, why have you not replied to my previous letter? And he said, oh, you know, I had to drive these rams to the palace the chief cook gave me, and I left the writing board in my house, and so I couldn't look up the interpretation. But now I'm back home, so I can look up the interpretation, and here's what you should do about the earthquake. And by the way, I went to that house, and when I was there, they didn't tell me that there was a sick child, so I then had to go back to check on the sick child, and I'll go back again tomorrow. I mean, it's no wonder he left the writing board in his house, right? It's a classic, oh, sorry, I didn't reply to your email thing. This is the kind of email I might write, actually. Oh, it's just so busy.
Oh, it's extraordinary. And what was it that sort of did for cuneiform culture? When does all this glory come to an end and why?
Well, it hangs on a very long time. It fades out quite gradually. So, I mean, the Persians take over Babylon in 539 BC, but that doesn't put an end to it. Because the Persians are famously tolerant. They just let people carry on the way they're doing before. Then Alexander the Great conquers Babylon. That doesn't put an end to it entirely either. Even by the point of the library, most people are not speaking Akkadian anymore. Actually, you know, Aramaic is taking over more and more, especially in the countryside, as people's first language.
And they're using alphabets for Aramaic rather than cuneiform script,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So cuneiform is already becoming a more elite thing at that time. And
is it worth thinking of that on the analogy of something like Church Latin in the Middle Ages?
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But we've also got Sumerian as well in this, remember? So there's two dead languages, actually, that they are working with by the very end. Nobody's spoken Sumerian since about 2000 BC. So Sumerian and Akkadian are both ancient languages at that time. So it becomes more and more the preserve of the elite. And by the time we get to the Hellenistic period, it's probably just a small selection of ancient families who work in the temples who are continuing to learn it, who are continuing to copy out these texts and keeping that culture alive. And they're still singing to the gods in Sumerian every single day. They're still keeping track of the heavens and writing it down in cuneiform. They're the ones who carry on to the end.
The extraordinary longevity of this culture, as you say, is, you know, down in part to the fact that clay tablets are so brilliantly durable. I love that you have a little epilogue. Is that we're still learning from them?
Oh, absolutely. So I came across this project called the Memory of Mankind Project, which is where they've decided to try to preserve our own culture now by inscribing some of the most important books of our era on clay tablets. Now, they're doing it with super high-tech forms of clay tablets. It's some kind of ceramic with microfilm-type printing, and they're depositing it all in a salt mine in Austria so that in the face of some kind of global technological meltdown or catastrophe, we'll still have the classics of our era written on clay. And this was directly inspired by cuneiform tablets and directly chosen because of the incredible durability of the medium.
Absolutely amazing. Selina Wisdom, thank you very much indeed for your time.